Just like to say good evening. My name is Don Ryan. I think I know many of you, but not all of you, so hopefully we can meet you before the night is over. Thank you for coming tonight. Very pleased to have with us the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank, Neil Kashkari. Neil is here. Neil, nice to see you.
Thanks, Don. Nice to be here.
We're going to be pretty informal about this. We're going to have a conversation. We'll talk about some of the key issues, maybe getting some discussion started, but then we really want to hear from you. I know Neil really wants to hear your questions. He likes tough questions too, right?
I do, absolutely.
What brings you to Marquette?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Don, for hosting. Thank you all for taking time out of your busy schedules. You know, I'm the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and one of the things that's unique about our country is that we have a distributed central bank. So 100 years ago, Congress created the Federal Reserve, but they said they don't want all the power concentrated in Washington, D.C. They want the central bank and the power to be distributed around the country. So they created the Board of Governors, which is in Washington, and 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, one of which is the Minneapolis Fed. It's the ninth bank. We represent the ninth Federal Reserve District, which covers the UP, part of Wisconsin, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, and Montana. So a big part of my job is to get out across the whole district to understand what's happening in the local economy so that when I go back to Washington, D.C. 8 times a year, I'm able to talk about here's what's happening in our region, in our district. So when we set interest rates for the whole country, we have an insight into what does that mean for the local economy. So I'm here to get to know the UP. This is my first time being here in the UP, meeting with small business owners, small businessmen and women, civic leaders, people in the community to hear firsthand how are things going, what are the challenges, makes me smarter, I can bring this back to Washington. So that's why I'm here, and that's why hearing directly from you is really important to me.
And just so you know, Neil actually started out as an aerospace engineer, believe it or not, went and got his MBA at Wharton School in Pennsylvania, went to work for Goldman Sachs, was an assistant secretary of the Treasury, and was in charge of the TARP program at that time, actually ran for governor of California, and now he's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. If I have it right, you're only going to be 43 years old in a couple of weeks.
I am. And yesterday I bought my first pair of reading glasses. It was a sad moment at the Detroit airport.
I wanted to tell you, you know, that we're glad to have you with us. And I'm not going to read this whole list, but I'm going to give it to you before you go. But, you know, you're visiting a pretty fascinating place. You know, Marquette, Ishpeming, Marquette County, we're recognized all the time. We've been recognized as the most underrated place in every state, Marquette, the best small city in America, best place for millennial job seekers, best place for young families in the top 10, top 10 places to retire, a bicycle-friendly community, a top-running community, a Michigan cool city, and an all-American county. So, you know, we get a lot of recognition, and that's only about a half of it. So we want you to come back often and learn more about it.
Absolutely. I'd love to. So first of all, I was born and raised in Ohio. I went to school in Illinois. So coming back to the Midwest, it's like coming home. Ohio, Michigan, Minnesota have a lot in common. So I feel very comfortable here, and people have been great welcoming me and all of my colleagues here. So I appreciate that.
Now, if you were, you know, if you were on CNBC today, or if you were on Fox Business News or Bloomberg, or the Ryan Report, for that matter.
Which I'll be in on Sunday. Yeah. So
The question they would ask, or I would ask, is, as everyone asks, what is the Fed going to do with interest rates? That seems to be how everyone knows what the Fed is.
That's right. Well, Congress, so we work for the American people. Congress has given us targets, a goal. Our goals, we call it a dual mandate. Number one is stable prices, so no high inflation. And we define that as 2% inflation. And then the second goal is maximum employment, put as many Americans back to work as possible. And in both of those goals, we are still coming up short. So as you know, the Federal Reserve has had very low interest rates, almost zero, since the financial crisis in 2009. And yet, inflation for the last 4 years keeps coming up below our 2% target. So we have a little ways to go there. And second, the job market is getting stronger, but as I analyze the labor force, and there's a lot of measurements, I think there still are some people who are on the sidelines who want jobs or who have part-time jobs and who want full-time jobs. So in both of those measurements, that says we should take our time when we go ahead and start raising rates again. There's not a huge urgency to raise rates because inflation is coming up low. If you go back many years, to the 70s, if you remember back then, we had really high inflation, really high mortgage rates. That's because the Federal Reserve lost control of inflation. And so no one wants that to happen again, but we're a long way away from that, so we feel like we can be patient to let the economy continue to heal before we start moving aggressively to raise rates.
Here's where you can give us some real insights. Now, what really goes on behind closed doors? Is there kicking and screaming, pounding on the table?
The Federal Reserve is a very collegial place. And in the spirit of transparency, all of our discussions at our official meetings, there's a transcript. And with a five-year lag, the full transcripts are released. After a few weeks, minutes are released, so kind of a summary. But then with a five-year lag, there's full transcripts released of all of the deliberations and all of the discussion. And so, you know, there's a wide range of opinions around the table. We've got members of the Board of Governors and the 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents from around the country have different opinions. Everyone's bringing their opinions forward. Everyone's talking about their local economy. And then we make the best collective decision we can.
And if you were watching those business shows, they would be concerned about what the Fed was going to do because of what effect it's going to have on the equity markets. Do you really care about that? And I assume you care. But
well, we pay attention.
Is it a factor?
It's a factor in the sense of this. When the stock market goes up, generally people feel wealthier, and they're more likely to spend money, either on a new TV or a new car or maybe remodel their house. So confidence is good. So we do factor it. We do pay attention, but that's not the key driver. The key driver for us is how do we put as many people back to work as possible while preventing the economy from overheating. Think about that. The economy can overheat, as it did in the 70s, and you had really high inflation, or the economy can stall. We want to avoid both of those. We're trying to adjust interest rates to keep it on an even keel. So we look at all of these factors, and we look at what's happening abroad, in Europe, in Asia, as factors for the U.S. economy, as we try to keep it from getting too hot or too cold.
The stock market's at a record high. Any thoughts about what's happening there?
Well, I think that if you look around the world, so the U.S. economy has been growing more slowly than we would all like. I think that that's safe to say. But it's not been terrible. It's not been great. But as you look around the world, the U.S. economy has done pretty well compared to Europe, as an example, especially given Brexit and the uncertainty about the U.K. and what does it mean for the Eurozone. Given the uncertainties around the world, many investors are investing in America as a safe place to invest. So that's part of why you see the dollar tends to strengthen when there's nervousness around the world, or maybe people are coming into our equity markets as well. Again, net-net, those are good things for America, but that by itself, just a strong equity market is not the final goal of what we're trying to achieve.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Britain decided to leave the European common market. The equity markets in the United States panicked. We've since more than recovered from that. But what is the long-term impact of that going to be? What is your view of that?
Yeah, the truth is we don't know for sure. And that's what makes people nervous. And if people are nervous, they don't know the future with great clarity. They're less likely to invest. They're less likely to take a risk. And so the reason that Brexit in the UK may be a big deal for the global economy is if it means that other countries in Europe might leave the Eurozone might get a lot smaller. Imagine this, if you go back to our founding of our country and our Civil War. Remember, we fought a war in our country to keep the Union together. The fear was if some states left, that could then lead to more states leaving, and then there may be no United States left. And so the same fear exists in Europe. If the UK leaves, and if other countries are encouraged to leave, maybe there won't be a Eurozone left way into the future. And so it's making everybody nervous, and we don't know exactly how the European politics of this are going to play out. It's probably going to take many years.
One of your big issues and one of your big concerns is too big to fail. I know we have a lot of bankers in the room, but we also have some who probably aren't bankers and aren't familiar with the terms. So first of all, tell us what it is.
Sure. So if you all think back to 2008, 2009, we had the terrible financial crisis. Not only was it devastating for homeowners, we had these big giant banks at the center of the U.S. economy that ran into real trouble. And they had to turn to the U.S. government and the taxpayers to bail them out. And the reason, and by the way, I ran the bailout. I was the guy in charge of that program. We hated that we had to do it. But the reason we did it is because if they had been allowed to collapse, they would have dragged down the whole U.S. economy. And instead of the Great Recession, we might have had the Great Depression. Think about how, you know, the big banks and the financial system are like the heart of the U.S. economy. You have a major heart attack, it can kill the patient. It doesn't just damage the heart, it kills the whole patient. So that's why we had to use taxpayer money in 2008. Now, we never, ever want to have to do that again. And so the question that I'm asking, and my colleagues at the Minneapolis Fed, have we done enough to prevent that from happening again? So in 2010, Congress passed what's called the Dodd-Frank Act to try to change bank regulations to make them safer. It has done some good. But I'm asking the question, has it gone far enough? My gut tells me no, it has not gone far enough. So we at the Minneapolis Fed are running a very serious process, bringing experts from around the country to look at a full range of options and to come up with our recommended plan that we're going to present to the public by the end of the year to hopefully address too big to fail once and for all so that we never ever have to do that again. And we're going to present it to the public and let you decide, have we done enough or should we do more?
Is the answer likely to require banks to be not as big?
Well, there are a number of ways.
Simplest
terms, you know, you hear about people talk about breaking up the banks as one of the alternatives, and that is one of the alternatives. There are other alternatives. You know, think about a nuclear reactor. A nuclear power plant does a lot of good. It provides power to the economy. But it can also be really dangerous if it gets into trouble. So nuclear reactors are huge. So you put a lot of regulations around them so that they virtually can't fail. So one option for the banks is to break them up. Another option is you regulate them like a nuclear reactor. You let them stay large, but you put so many regulations around them, they virtually can't fail. You can never say never, but you can make them a lot safer than they are today. So we're looking at all of these options to try to figure out what provides the most safety with the fewest and the least cost to the economy.
The U.S. has to operate in the whole world. We obviously can't control banks in other countries. There are big banks in other countries as well. How do we deal with that issue? What's the answer there?
Well, you're right. It would be great if all countries made the same decisions and all countries modified their regulations to deal with this problem, but we can't force them to do that. So my view is we should come up with one set of regulations that applies to any bank, American or foreign, that wants to do business in our country and hold them to those standards. And if we show other countries that there is a way to have a banking sector that can grow and that can meet the needs of the economy and still be safe, then we can show other countries and maybe they'll follow our lead. We have to do what's right for us and then encourage other countries to follow.
Part of tonight's program is to get some questions from you. The fellow standing back here is Ron. Ron has a microphone. I'll ask one more question, but you can kind of be looking at him, and if you have a question, just call him over, and we'll try to get some questions from the audience as well. But as we go forward with this issue, the Federal Reserve is not in the position to lobby Congress, is it?
Correct. So that's right.
What will you do to try to accomplish what you feel is the right answer for the too big to fail issue?
So just as Don said, the Federal Reserve is a non-political, non-partisan agency, and we're ultimately accountable to the American people through your elected representatives, but we don't lobby Congress one way or the other, and we don't pick sides on partisan issues. But what we can do is we can inform the public about our analysis. So everything we're doing at the Minneapolis Fed on Too Big to Fail is public. If you go to our website, minneapolisfed.org, you can watch all of the symposiums that we have videos of them to see for yourselves what the experts are saying. All of the materials that they're presenting are there. All of my speeches and my Q&As are there for you to learn and make up your own minds. And then at the end of the year, we're going to publish our recommendation to the public on our website, you know, to the media, so that you all can read it and you can make up your mind. At the end of the day, the people have to make a decision about how much risk you're willing to take in a banking sector, how much safety you want, and you express those opinions through your own elected representatives. And so at the end of the day, we have to count on the people to make the decisions that, you know, it's your job ultimately to make, but we want to inform you and provide you all the information that we can.
Really do want questions, and I understand none of them are too tough.
I always say this to audiences, you will show me respect if you ask me your toughest question, because there's a good chance if you're thinking of a question, somebody else is thinking of the same question. And I'd much rather get it out in the open and have a chance to address it than have a few of you go home wondering what the answer is. And so I would appreciate that if you would ask me whatever's on your mind. Yes, sir.
We have a question right here.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Hi, Joe Sable, small business owner in Marquette. What can you say about regulatory capture? What are you doing to suppress that or change it or to so it doesn't happen? And explain what it is for the people who may
sure.
not be familiar.
So regulatory capture is an issue where regulators get to know the institutions that they're supervising over the course of many years, and they become friends. You know, it's human nature. You see somebody, even if you're not working for the same company, if you are working with somebody, you get become friends and you look out for them, and then all of a sudden the regulator is a little less tough, maybe not as tough as they should be. Well, it starts, and by the way, when I was at Treasury, I'm gonna tell you a story, sorry, this will just take me a minute. I saw this firsthand. So when we were deciding which banks we were gonna use government money to put into, they had to apply with their banking regulator, and there were four federal banking regulators at the time. And all what I found is all of those banking regulators were looking out for their banks like they were their children. And so they'd make recommendations, and we at Treasury would look at the recommendation and say, how can you possibly be recommending this bank? So what we ended up doing is we created a peer review process where the regulators had to test each other. And only if they gave us a consensus report did we ultimately make that investment. So regulatory capture is real. It starts with tone at the top. You know, it starts with me. It starts with the other senior leaders at the Minneapolis Fed to make it very clear who we work for. We work for Main Street. We work for the American people. We are here to make sure that the banks in our district are run in a safe and sound manner, are able to provide credit to the communities, and that we are accountable to the people, to all of you. And that's why I'm here. That's why I'm doing this in a very open way, to hear directly from you, to answer directly to you, to set a tone for everybody in my organization about who we ultimately report to, and then me holding them accountable that they're really going to do a good job. And if we see that they're not, we'll make changes. I don't know how else to address it other than that, given that I know regulatory capture is real, and it's a very human flaw. It's a very human vulnerability that we all have.
Question right here.
Yes. Hugo Izaguirre. I'm a faculty member here in Northern Michigan. Just a couple of other ways in which international or foreign factors can affect what we do here. One is, since you were saying that, you know, that there is confidence that the U.S. is doing better, doing well. Well, that's, I think, one of the issues why it's easy to run deficits in the U.S., because there is always going to be people buying those bonds, and which is not the case in other countries.
Sure.
So it's like a good but a curse at the same time. And I don't know how that affects or limits. I mean, you don't get that signal from the markets that, you know, you are borrowing too much.
Right.
And the other one is that a lot of the dollars, that's also very particular of the U.S., that a lot of the dollars are not here. A lot of the dollars are all over the world.
Right.
And in many countries, it's like a second currency that you use. So I don't know how much you control the amount of money.
Well,
with the money that it's
around the world.
Around the world.
Well, we do control the latter. So the Federal Reserve, the way we set interest rates is by controlling the amount of, effectively, the amount of dollars in the global economy. And if we put more dollars out there, interest rates go down. If we bring dollars are scarce, interest rates go up. So we do have control on that, and we do look at the global supply of dollars, not just within the U.S. economy. We look at it wherever it is around the world. But your point about the Treasury borrowing cost is exactly right. So one of the interesting things that happens in the last 5 or 6 years, anytime there's any kind of crisis around the world, the yields, the interest rates on U.S. Treasury government bonds go down, because people around the world get scared and they say, we don't know where to park our money, so let's park it where we think it's safest, and that ends up being the U.S. government bonds. So even though we do have big fiscal deficits, and even though long-term we have these underfunded pension plans or underfunded Social Security or Medicare and Medicaid, there are real concerns long-term about the health of the U.S. fiscal system. In the short term, we're still the strongest weakling, so to speak. Like, of all the countries around the world, people want to come to America because relatively we are stronger. And so at the end of the day, it's critical that Congress and the executive branch make those tough choices to put us on a strong fiscal path long into the future. It's not a near-term crisis, but long-term it absolutely needs to be addressed.
We have a question right over here.
Hi. I'm an assistant professor of economics from Michigan Tech, just about 2 hours away from here.
Thanks for coming here.
Thank you. My first question is, when are you coming to Michigan Tech? And second question is, there are some people who believe that the end of the Glass-Steagall Act was responsible for the financial crisis to some degree, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on that, and if there are any new regulations in place to maybe mimic or to replace the Glass-Steagall Act.
Sure, thank you. Well, first of all, as soon as you invite me, be happy to come back out, and Ron here can talk to Ron afterwards. We'd love to come visit your college. So Glass-Steagall, after the Great Depression in the 1930s, Congress at the time passed a whole bunch of different regulations to try to make sure the Great Depression couldn't happen again. One of them was the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial banking, traditional lending to homeowners and to businesses, from investment banking, securities underwriting, IPOs, stocks and bonds, things like that. And that worked, and then in the late 90s, it was repealed. And investment banking and commercial banking were allowed to rejoin and come back together again. Now, as I look at the crisis that we experienced in 08 and 09, I don't believe that that was a direct result of the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Nonetheless, and so some people today are suggesting that we reinstate it. I'm not against that. I don't think reinstating Glass-Steagall is necessarily a bad idea. I don't necessarily, though, think it would solve the problem by itself. I still think some of the banks would still be too big to fail, even if you reimpose Glass-Steagall today. So I'm open to considering it, and these are some of the ideas that we're looking at. But I think we need to make sure that the banks, part of what we need to do is make sure that they really have enough capital, enough buffer against all the bad things that we can't really foresee to make sure that they could absorb those shocks. And Glass-Steagall, at least that piece of it, doesn't address that directly.
Thanks. Question right here.
Thank you. I'm David Williams. I'm the CEO of Upper Peninsula State Bank, headquartered in Escanaba, office in Iron Mountain, and we're probably the only bank in the Western Hemisphere actually building a branch these days in Gladstone. I'm also a Michigan Tech grad. I sit on your CDAC. I missed our meeting in May. I apologize for that. But I'll get to know you better, I hope, through that. My question has to do with bank regulations. And we're about a $180 million bank. Capital ratio at 17%. Strong earnings, strong metrics across the board. There's a few proposals out there floating around. I'm more familiar with the FDIC Vice Chairman Thomas Honig's proposal, where there's regulatory relief for banks, traditional banks, when you draw the line at 10% capital or above. So we don't have derivatives. I don't have any of those things.
Right.
I run a safe, sound, community-focused, community decision-based bank. Yet I deal with bank examinations and regulatory burden to watch some of these bigger banks that have the same ones, same set of rules for the bigger banks that do a lot of these things. I'm wondering if you can share with a relative aspect, maybe to the too big to fail, your perspective on some of these proposals that are floating around out there. Again, Thomas Honig.
Sure.
And the other one, I can't think of his name now.
Anselin.
Right.
Anselin. To allow us to continue to serve our communities, I have a bigger compliance department than I do credit analyst department right now.
Right.
So I'd like your views.
I appreciate the question, and I get this a lot, and I agree with. I'm very sympathetic to that view. Like, I do believe that coming out of the crisis, we passed the Dodd-Frank Act to try to prevent these too big to fail banks from destabilizing the economy. One of the problems is they've caught a whole bunch of other banks that are not actually risky for the U.S. economy, and so my view is we need to really address too big to fail, and if we can really address it and have confidence that we've addressed the biggest banks, then we can relax some of those regulations that are burdening the small banks that are playing the vital role in the community that you're talking about. So I don't know if, and I certainly know Mr. Honig, and I've just looked at a high level at Chairman Henserling's proposals. I'm not sure if I necessarily agree with the details of their solutions to too big to fail. We're looking at them. But I do agree with the broader point of, hey, let's relax the regulations on the small banks that are not systemically risky for the country. Well, this is the thing is, you know, politics is not it's not the Fed's job, so to speak, but these things end up getting wound together. And so right now when people are nervous that we haven't solved too big to fail, sometimes they view any relaxing of bank regulations as, oh, you're taking it easy on Wall Street. And so my gut tells me we really need to convince people that we've solved too big to fail, and then we'll be able to relax it on everybody else. I'd be surprised if you can do the latter first.
Is there any sentiment in Congress at all to deal with the issue he raises?
I think there is, but again, I think that it's a little bit partisan. I think that some people on the right are more sympathetic to go ahead and do that. Some people on the left are concerned that, wait a minute, that's just going to undercut the regulations of the big banks. And so that's why I think these things end up getting woven together.
I think this has really forced some small banks to consolidate and look at other options to be able to meet those requirements, especially the financial requirements that come with it.
No, absolutely. In fact, this is one of the things. Sometimes you make a regulatory change to solve one problem, and without realizing it, you might actually make that problem worse. And so big banks historically have had an advantage over small banks because they're able to borrow more cheaper, because they're perceived to be too big to fail. So that's one advantage big banks have. Well, with these regulatory burdens, if you have to add one compliance officer, that really changes your bottom line. If a big bank has to add one compliance officer, it's not such a big deal. So the economies of scale for big banks, it's a bigger benefit for them with these new regulations. So the new regulations have made this problem worse in some ways. And so we need to step back and take a fresh look at it.
So the state of Michigan they started 2016, there was 100 state or state charter banks. We're down to about 94, and there's some announced mergers. So what you're saying, Don, is it's actually happening. There's banks that are at a level, a size, that they're serving their community that they can't continue. So while I appreciate, truly, genuinely appreciate what you're saying, is one can't happen maybe without the other. In the meantime, some damage will be done. We're fortunate that we have the capital we do, the earnings we do, that we're actually able to continue to grow, but I'm watching my brethren suffer through this, and the numbers dwindle and dwindle and dwindle. So
yeah,
sooner the better.
Understood.
Do you have advice?
Well, I mean, this is, you need to express your concerns and your opinions, not just to me. Even more importantly, is express them to your elected representatives. Because at the end of the day, that's your voice. And I'm not encouraging you one way or the other. I'm just saying, express your opinion.
This should be an issue where there are a lot of Congress people representing small districts and small banks where, you know, if you can get them together, something could happen. But it's a difficult challenge.
And by the way, every time, just so you know, every time I go back to Washington, D.C., I take time around our official meetings to go visit with senators, congressmen, and congresswomen from the 9th Federal Reserve District to share with them what we're hearing across the community and to hear from them. What are important to them? What are they hearing from their constituents? And many of them, on both parties, have raised this issue to me. So I think they are getting the message, probably not quite ready to push it forward yet. Thank you. Thank you.
Right here we have a question. Yes, sir.
So my question is negative interest rates. I imagine you're not heading in that direction right now. Other countries have looked at that. Can you envision a situation where you would consider negative interest rates?
Well, so this is something that we would say never, right? Nothing is impossible, but it's not very likely. And, you know, the U.S. economy is different from other economies. Our economy is larger and more complex in many ways. So it isn't clear that it would work. So here's the idea of a negative interest rate. If you have interest rates at zero, you're trying to get people to borrow, encourage you to borrow to go buy a new car, go buy a house, for a business to go invest in a factory. It just tries to get the money flowing in the economy again by lowering the cost of a loan. Well, once you get to zero, the old view was, well, that's it, that you've done all you can do. Well, some countries have adopted negative interest rates. Imagine you go to the bank to take out a mortgage, and the bank is paying you to take out a mortgage. Kind of weird, isn't it? Well, so that's in theory a way, the math says that's a way to get the economy moving, that it's more stimulative rather than zero. But it actually is having some perverse effects. It's so psychologically jarring, like it's so contrary to all of our expectations, it seems like it's actually unsettling people. If we were to adopt negative rates, you'd probably react to that and say, wow, they must really be concerned about the economy if they're going to negative rates. You know, in Japan, they've gone to negative rates, which they expected to lower their currency, the Japanese yen versus the dollar. The yen has strengthened. So sometimes these really unusual policies have unexpected outcomes. And so this is something that I would never say never to, but I think it's not very likely in the US.
We have a question over here.
My name is Christian Verardi. Kind of on the negative interest rate side, with interest rates being so low right now, what does the Fed have in place to combat a downturn in the economy? They can't without going negative, basically.
Sure. Well, there's a number of tools. So coming out of the financial crisis, the Fed did something which generated a lot of attention and some controversy called quantitative easing, as one example. The idea of that was we manage interest rates by moving short-term rates, basically overnight borrowing rates that businesses borrow, up and down. And we lowered it, the Fed lowered it. I wasn't there at the time. But then to try to get longer-term rates down, you know, if you're buying a house, you may plan to live in that house for 20 years. So the overnight rate doesn't matter to you so much. What's the interest rate going to be over 5 years or over 10 years? It's actually longer-term rates that drive business investment decisions and longer-term investment decisions. So to drive longer-term interest rates down, the Fed expanded its balance sheet by buying longer-term treasuries and mortgages and mortgage-backed securities. And that worked. That drove down longer-term rates. So there's always the possibility, if needed, that the Fed could go back to its quantitative easing programs to drive down longer-term rates in the future. Another issue is another potential policy tool are changing expectations. This is where economics is very interesting and very complicated. Part of all of our decisions as consumers is how we feel about the future and what we think interest rates are going to be doing in the future. If you thought interest rates are going to be climbing really fast in the future, that might affect your decision whether you want to buy a car or buy a house, or if you knew interest rates are going to be low in the future. So another tool that's on the table is there's what we call forward guidance, which is to tell the public, hey, we're going to keep rates low for a really long period of time. That also has the ability to stimulate economic growth as well. And so you're right, when we hit the, we call it the zero lower bound, zero interest rates, we're not out of bullets yet. We do have other tools that we could turn to if we needed to. But the good news is our outlook is for moderate economic growth. Our base case scenario is continued economic growth. We're not forecasting a recession around the corner. Obviously, we don't know the future perfectly. It could happen, but that's not our base case scenario, so hopefully we won't come there.
Before we get to our next question, that is a question I asked you earlier today, and there are people who are, you know, speculating we could be heading for a recession, but the Fed doesn't see it, at least you don't see it that way.
Not right now. When you look at the data, you know, the job market, we had a very strong job report last week. The prior couple months were much more muted, so we were happy to see last week's job report. We don't want to overreact to any one job report, but it seems like the economy continues to create jobs, which is a good thing. We're continuing to bring workers off the sideline, which is a good thing. And as I travel around the 9th District, you know, the economy seems to be doing all right, even here, which is very tied to natural resources and mining. You know, oil prices are low, the dollar is relatively strong. That's tough for exporters. You know, I was in the Bakken in North Dakota, which is part of my district.
Right.
And they also felt some optimism, right? They were happy that oil was back up around 50. 50 is a lot better than 26. It's not as good as 100, but they also felt some optimism. So when I travel around the 9th District, by and large, I think people feel cautiously optimistic, and that's what we're seeing nationally as well.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, I'm changing the focus a little bit with my question. I work in healthcare, finance of healthcare, and healthcare is a huge cost of governmental spending, expected to increase with our baby boomers getting older. Of course, we have the Accountable Care Act that President Obama passed several years ago. There's discussion with the current president-elect that maybe they'll repeal parts of it. I mean, we're a little bit unsure about what the future is of parts of that Accountable Care Act. But I think everyone agrees that medical costs have just keep increasing and increasing, and it's somewhat of a challenge because as old people get older, medical costs get higher, no matter what you do or how healthy you are. But do you look at healthcare costs, governmental paid healthcare costs, in what you do? Do you have thoughts about the Accountable Care Act? And kind of, maybe no one's asked this yet, but about the president candidates and how that comes into play in your world?
Sure. Well, these are all good questions. Let me take the easiest one first, which is views on the presidential candidates. So we are strictly prohibited. We have policies prohibiting us from participating in any partisan politics or weighing in for any candidates or endorsing any candidates. So the answer to that one is no. In terms of healthcare, we do look at healthcare costs because inflation, keeping inflation in check, is one of our core missions, as well as keeping people employed. And so we do look at healthcare inflation as a big chunk of the U.S. economy and a big driver of inflation. So we do pay very close attention to it. Now, in terms of what to do about it, this, unfortunately, is nothing we can control. So we can control the overall level of prices in the economy, but we can't control the relative amount of spending within the economy, whether it's healthcare or defense or education. That's set by Congress and the executive branch and the White House when they come up with an annual budget and decide either on where government spending is going to go or what regulations they're going to apply either to the healthcare sector, be it the Affordable Care Act, or any other sector as well. So unfortunately, we pay close attention because it does matter for the U.S. economy, but it's not something that we're able to control.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, my name is John Petraski. You were talking about how, you know, the Fed was able to buy Treasury bonds when they were concerned about long term. And one of the things that I think is that we get away with doing things like that only because we're viewed as the world's reserve currency right now. And if that ever gets shaken a bit, your institution and others are going to really lose a lot of options that you might be able to employ now without too much trouble, but they aren't going to work later on. And as we build up these trillions of dollars in debt, I think that does an impact on the security of us having those options, because we're not going to, if it's a competitive market to who's going to be the world's currency, it's going to be a totally different thing. And
right.
I just think you'd appreciate if you comment on that.
No, you're 100% correct. Now, the good news or the bad news, depending on where you sit, is that the best alternative, the most likely alternative for the dollar as the world's reserve currency is the euro. And the euro's in, there's some uncertainty about the eurozone today. And so hopefully the eurozone will stay together. And, you know, the U.S. economy will be much better off if there's a strong, healthy, vibrant euro as well. But you're right. I mean, we have confidence of the world right now. The confidence is there until it's not. And if it's not, all of a sudden we could be in for a hard adjustment period. And so it's, to this gentleman's question, it's much better that we deal with our fiscal imbalances soon rather than letting them build and build and build until someday that confidence may be lost. And then it'll be much more painful to deal with it then. So you're right.
Question back here.
Mm-hmm. Marquette, AIG was part of the TARP program, so I have to ask, what did the derivatives and the CDOs, did they contribute to the disaster in 2008? And what has been done to kind of correct this wild speculation?
Yeah, so a great question. So AIG, this giant insurance company, was rated AAA. So they were able to get a lot of cheap funding from investors all around the world. And then they used that funding not just to write insurance, but they used that basically to speculate on derivative contracts with other hedge funds and Wall Street banks. You could think of it as like they built a casino on top of an insurance company. And that caused the downfall in AIG. So AIG was required the biggest of all the bailouts. AIG required the biggest bailout. And an insurance company by itself shouldn't have been that risky. It was because of all of that gambling that they did up at the top. So you're exactly right. That was a big contributor to the crisis. What's been done since then is that AIG and some of the other big insurance companies have come under the regulatory net of the Federal Reserve. So one of the things that the Dodd-Frank Act did is it gave the Fed the power to designate certain banks and non-banks like AIG as systemically important, so that they would be under heightened scrutiny, more regulation. Now, something bad has happened. The bad thing that's happened is that I think it's MetLife, another big insurer, sued the federal government to say, we don't want to be under these new regulations. And they found a judge who agreed with them and said, yeah, you're not going to be under these new regulations. And so this is the analogy I'll give you. Imagine if you go to your doctor and your doctor gives you a diagnosis that you have a very serious disease. And you don't like that diagnosis. So you say, forget that doctor. I'm going to go find another doctor who tells me what I want to hear. Well, so you go find another doctor who gives you the diagnosis you want. That doesn't change whether or not you're sick. That's just the label. That's just the message. So that's what, unfortunately, we have right now. Some institutions are trying to get out of the additional regulations by suing in court. So my view is we have to take aggressive action to make sure that that does not happen, because we don't want another AIG to happen 10 years from now or 50 years from now, because it was very costly for the American people.
If you have a question, we'll get you the mic right here. Just raise your hand. Let Derek or Ron know if you have a question. They'll bring the mic over.
Yes, that'd be great.
Al Martin, I'm a retired mathematician from NMU.
No math questions, please.
No, this is not a math question. Why isn't there a plan to treat the banks the way General Motors was treated, rather than bailing them out, provide a safety net for the public good, but let the shareholders and the bondholders, the administrators, take the proper hit?
Thank you.
Could you comment on that,
please? Yeah, well, that's where we want to get to. And I'll tell you, that's exactly where we want to get to. You think about, I'll give you another analogy. You mentioned General Motors. Think about the tech bubble that we had in the 1990s. Big tech boom in Silicon Valley. A lot of bad investments. And then it crashed. And it devastated those companies and their investors. But it didn't bring down the whole U.S. economy. And it didn't require a bailout. That's what our financial sector should be able to withstand as well. Well, the reason that the big banks right now are different in our economy is because they're so big. They're like the heart and the arteries, moving money all the way around the financial system, all the way around the economy. So that if they plunged into bankruptcy, you know, the Lehman Brothers is the one big bank that did go into bankruptcy. And it, I think they're still working out all of the legal contracts and who owes what to whom. It's a big mess with thousands and thousands of contracts and thousands of lawyers arm wrestling over the pieces. Well, if you multiply that by a whole bunch of different banks, it just leads to chaos in the financial system, and the money stops flowing to the businesses and the homeowners who need it. So that's why the problem is harder to solve. But that doesn't change the fact that we need to solve it. And so that's why some people say, well, no, let's just now, when the economy's strong, some people say, let's break them up now so that they're smaller and they can't bring down the whole economy. Another group is saying, well, it's okay, you can leave them large, but put so much capital in them, they can't fail, or they virtually can't fail. Like a nuclear reactor. A nuclear reactor is really dangerous. You've got uranium, you've got all the dangerous elements in there, but there's so many regulations around it, they're still safe. And so that's what we're looking at, because we need to make sure that it can't happen again.
Question in the back.
Jim Rahoy, I'm a finance officer in town. It almost seems like with the Fed's low interest rate, you're encouraging spending, obviously. What are you doing to encourage savings?
Well, this is the...
That was my question, by the way. Older people are concerned about that.
Here, like the credit unions, I mean, you money market, the older people, you're getting less than 1%. Yeah. So they're not making any. So what are you doing to encourage people to save it and get that mindset?
Well, that's... this is a tough, complicated question that you're asking, which is long-term, there's no question we need to save more. One of the problems going into the crisis, I remember 2005 and 2006, if you turn on the business news, say CNBC or Bloomberg TV, they'd be celebrating that the U.S. consumer has stepped up once again. Home prices or home sales have broken new records, and the U.S. savings rate went to zero, or even negative by some estimates. And so the savings rate has bounced back up. I don't remember right now if it's 5% or 6%, but it has come back quite a bit from where it was, the low level. Long-term savings are important so that we have enough money to invest in our economy. We can invest in infrastructure, invest in long-term assets. But right now, with long-term interest rates being as low as they are, around the world, we're seeing too much savings, not too little savings. And so these are very complicated economic topics that, frankly, economists have not fully figured out. If you back up, for the last 30 years, interest rates around the world have been gradually declining. And we don't exactly know why that is. Part of it is because populations all around the world have been aging, so their spending patterns have changed. Partly it's because of the adoption of technology and increased trade, but partly people think that there's been too much saving all around the world. And so if there's excess saving in China with these global capital markets, a lot of that money is moving to the U.S., and that's part of why we have such low interest rates. And so I'm not trying to avoid your question. It's just a very complicated topic to say, how do we get more spending at the same time as more savings? We need more innovation. We need more productivity growth if you want to have both of those things happening at the same time.
Some of us do remember when you could buy a CD and get 5%, 6%, 7% interest.
Yeah,
it's difficult as people get older and look for conservative investments to find opportunities.
I know it is, and it's tough for pension plans. But the flip side is, if we did have 5% on your CD, what would your mortgage be at? 8%?
Right.
9%? And then, young families and first-time homebuyers would be saying, holy cow, how can I be expected to buy a house and pay 8 or 9% on a mortgage? And so, you know, there's no easy answer.
All right, we have a question in the back of the room. Justin.
Hi, Justin with TV6. I was just curious about the process of how the Fed makes decisions. Is it like the presidential cabinet where there's advisors that give advice to the president and then he makes a final decision on interest rates? Or is it more of a popular vote like the Supreme Court among Board of Governors?
Sure, so there's a vote. So there are right now 5 members at the Board of Governors, and there are 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents. And the 5 governors vote all 8 times a year, and then which of the presidents vote rotates around. So I'm not a voter in 2016. I will be a voter in 2017. So I'm at every meeting, and all the presidents are. We give our opinion about the local economy and the national economy. And then at the end of the meeting, a vote is taken of who are the eligible voters in that meeting. So when that vote is taken, I'm not speaking up at that last part of the meeting, though my opinions have already been expressed. Next year, I will be a voter. And this is a process that Congress created literally 100 years ago, and we just follow that process. So it is a vote, but who the voters are changes.
We have a question out here. Yes.
Yes, my name is Karen Blake. I'm a refugee from the home building industry from the late 90s. Came up here from Chicago. And aside from the movies and the books and everything that talked about that, there was some really incredibly stupid decisions that were being made by bankers and investors back then that we in the home building industry, we could see that coming. And my concern is that what is in place now to prevent, whether it's home building or cars or anything else, what is to prevent people in the banks that are too big to fail from making those incredibly bad decisions again?
Well, I'll say it, you know, when I describe the crisis, I say it only a little bit differently than what you said, which is I think we all participated in a nationwide delusion that home prices only go up. And by the way, the home builders did too. The banks did, the home builders did, the realtors did, the home buyers did. I bought a house in California in 2005. I certainly didn't see it coming either. And so, and this happens in society. Societies are prone to mass delusion, whether it's eToys in the 90s as the best, you know, internet company ever, or the housing boom. So unfortunately, we can't legislate wisdom. Right? There's a good chance that 20 years from now, or 30 years from now, or 80 years from now, society's going to do something really stupid once again. So I wish we could prevent that. I wish we could remember the lessons and not make the same mistake. But unfortunately, we keep seeing the same movie over and over and over again. So my view is, let's assume we're going to do something stupid as a society. So let's make sure our systems are strong enough to endure that without causing a Great Depression or without requiring massive taxpayer bailouts. And hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully we'll remember the lessons. But I'm saying let's assume that we don't and make it so that we can withstand it.
Question way in the back of the room.
And I have a kind of a twofold question. The Federal Reserve has 2 mandates, and you stated one is to control inflation and the other is for unemployment. And compared to the other central banks, I'm not sure if this is a true fact that, like in Europe, that they only have 1 mandate. So we're kind of chasing 2 rabbits. So that's the second part of my question is, how does the Fed view the unemployment rate as it relates to growth? And there's some opinion that the only way that we're going to address the future deficits is by growth in the economy, but at the same time, you know, you're trying to fight inflation. So can you address that?
Sure. So you're right. Many other countries have what's a single mandate, which is just an inflation target for their central bank. And they view having an employment mandate as maybe running in conflict once in a while. And it's not impossible. They could be in conflict. So for example, if a lot of, in the 70s, you had high unemployment and high inflation, how do you solve that? Those two things are in conflict. Right now, we're in a situation where both of them are in the same direction. Inflation's a little low, and there's still some slack in the labor market. And what the Federal Reserve has said is that we're gonna view those two mandates roughly equally and take a balanced view of those two if they end up being on opposite sides of one another. And I think it works. I think it works for the U.S. economy. I think it works for our political system, having this dual mandate. In terms of employment, let me make sure I'm, ask me the second part of your question again. Got it. So right now, the headline unemployment rate is around 5%. I can't remember where it came out Friday, if it was 4.9. It's around 5%. And by some measures, some people think that that's roughly as low as it can go, given the frictions in the U.S. economy and people changing jobs. But there are people who are not counted in that 5% number, some people who've given up looking, or people who are stuck in a part-time job who want a full-time job. That's why I think there's still some slack in the labor market, and we need to put those people back to work. But let's assume we've done that. Once we've put everybody back to work who wants to work full-time, how do we get the economy to grow faster? Well, it really comes from two things. One is it comes from productivity growth, which means innovation, breakthrough technologies that allow us to produce more for the same number of workers. So R&D ends up being very, very important to that long-term innovation. Think about the internet as an example of that, or things like Uber and maybe self-driving cars some days, boosting innovation, boosting productivity growth. The second source of economic growth is population growth. And this is a big advantage for America relative to many other countries, because our population is still growing. It's in part still growing because we have immigrants coming from around the world who want to come to America and want to work here. And that's a big advantage for our country. If we have a population that's not growing, it's much, much harder to have economic growth. And so my personal view is we should utilize immigration to our advantage as a source for economic growth, because if you have a growing population, you need more food, good for farmers. You need more houses, good for home builders. You need more doctors, you need everything. And that helps the economy to grow. So at the end of the day, it's not monetary policy, it's productivity growth, so innovation, and population growth.
We're not there yet, but we're getting close to the end of our appointed hour. We don't want anyone to leave saying, I wanted to ask a question but didn't get a chance, so make sure you let Derek know.
Well, I didn't have the microphone, I figured I would ask a question
too.
All
right, okay, go ahead.
So what is your opinion on the current situation, escalating situation in regards to student debt, and how it's going to affect young people in the future, and perhaps putting off the payment or purchase of a home or a new car? And is that something that you guys kind of keep a pulse on?
We do. We keep an eye on it, because it does affect, as you said, spending on other things. And it is a huge challenge and a huge problem. And you know, this is not, unfortunately, this is on the basket of things that the Fed can't control. It really is pure fiscal policy that Congress and the executive branch have to make decisions about. But you know, we need an educated workforce, and we need affordable education at the same time. And you know, when we push more and more people to go to college, if you have more demand for something, economics says the price of that is going to go up. So we're seeing that. The price of college is going up as there's more demand. So one of the solutions, and it's not a perfect solution, there are technologies that are showing promise in certain classes, use certain ways to reach many more students than can be reached face-to-face. I think we should be looking at everything as ways of educating our workforce and keeping costs down. By the way, that doesn't mean everybody has to go to a four-year college. As I've been traveling around the UP and traveling around the 9th District, there are a lot of jobs unfilled for skilled trades where they can't find enough people, either it's electricians or welders, machinists, etc. Those don't require a four-year degree in many cases. We should be encouraging people to pursue all of those. So it is a big factor. And then the last thing I'll say is students need to be smart about the decisions that they're making. I mean, how many students go to a four-year college, take on oodles of student loan debt, maybe they don't finish, and then they've got a lot of debt without a degree, or maybe they major in something and there's no demand for that. And you know, if you take out a lot of debt and you end up working at Starbucks, that's a tough thing. So students need to take some responsibility for their own decisions and make sure, are there actual demand? Is there demand for these skills that I'm getting in this university? If there are not, you should be majoring in something else.
Question right here.
My name is Jim Eibel. I'm a capital markets professional. I work at the Federal Home Loan Bank. So, but my question is this. One of your colleagues wrote a book saying that central banks are the only game in town, Muhammad Al-Aryan. I guess, what are your thoughts on that? And if, in fact, you believe that's true, how important is the Fed's messaging, and what are you doing with respect to that in terms of market volatility and making sure that we don't have unnecessary market volatility?
Sure. Well, I think, so Mohammed Alarian is a former colleague. When I worked in the private sector, he worked at the same firm. I don't agree with that. I don't agree that the central banks are the only game in town. In recent years, there has not been a lot of consensus in Washington to make economic policy decisions, fiscal policy decisions. So I know where he's coming from. But the Fed can only do certain things. Hopefully you've gotten a sense today, we can set interest rates, we can control the money supply, but we can't do anything about student loan debt. We can't do anything about decisions to spend, whether it's in healthcare. That really is up to Congress. It really is up to the President and the White House. And so elections matter. And this is, again, it's up to the American people to express what's important to you through the ballot box and to your elected representatives to take on these important issues, because the central bank can't do it. In terms of communication, I try to focus my messaging on longer-term economic issues and explaining what the Federal Reserve does and what we're focused on to the public, to you, just like I'm doing here today. To have, as I'm hopefully I'm being plain-spoken and just being candid about what we know and what we don't know. I don't think it's helpful to try to move the markets around to my view on interest rates or to try to influence the markets in some way. I'd rather focus on longer-term issues, and then the markets will sort themselves out.
Question right here.
Yes. Just a comment, brief comment, because I come from a country where it's a single mandate. There's a single mandate.
Which country is that?
Peru. And one of the issues or the reasons behind it, in part, were like the unemployment is considered more political, a more political issue, so that it is viewed as, if the Fed or the central bank gets involved in that, it's going to be more play with the politics, you know, like what people want, and, sure. and instead of being only technical.
Right.
And the other one is that although, you know, what the government does affects your work and what you do affects the government's work, there is more overlap regarding unemployment, and you can have like contradictory policies and all, you know, different things. So that's just a comment about, you know, sure. the benefits of having just one mandate.
Sure. But if you go back and you look at American history, so the U.S. people, the American people, have been very resistant of having a central bank at all. So Alexander Hamilton created America's first central bank. It lasted about 20 years. Then there was another central bank, and then they repealed it. And then finally, after a series of financial crises in 1913, Congress said, we need a central bank. And so it's with great reluctance that we have a central bank at all. And so I feel like it's partly to say to the American people, I know you don't want a central bank, but we need to have one. And don't worry, the central bank's going to look out for you, too. It's kind of how I feel like why we have a dual mandate. And I think it works for America.
And a little complaint.
Please. Is it just a little one? That's it?
UP statistics. Typically, when you want to study the economy of the UP, there's no good information already processed at the level of the UP. And you go to your...
the local university, the professor at the university who'd be providing that data.
And we do some of that, but there is no, like, you have to collect very basic data to come up. And typically in other parts, you just go, let's go to the Fed data.
Okay, fair enough.
And you can see, you know, North Dakota, South Dakota, you know, and our peninsula is not, there's no line, there's no column for our peninsula. I hope that in the future, your economic department or research department includes us.
I will look into it. You have my word. Thank you for raising it.
Just a question about today. We didn't talk about it much, but what did you see today? Did you, anything surprise you? Anything really make an impression on you as you visited some businesses and industries?
Well, you know, I visited, we had some meetings with small business men and women. We had some meetings with entrepreneurs, with civic leaders. And then we visited the big sawmill,
Potlatch,
and then RTI, the medical device right. company. I think the optimism, again, I felt generally there are strains, there are challenges to overcome, but by and large, people felt quite optimistic, which was great to see. And I got to tell you that the tech company that we saw, the medical device company, is pretty impressive. I mean, they're doing some pretty cutting edge work up here, which was neat to see, and they're hiring a lot of local grads. You know, to staff their facilities, both in R&D as well as in high-tech manufacturing. So that was nice to see the balance. You know, you've got traditional even the sawmill, pretty high-tech sawmill. I mean, they've implemented a lot of technology in the last few years. So overall, I leave pretty optimistic.
Well, I've interviewed a lot of people in my career, and few come with the knowledge and the willingness to share that you have today. But I was going to wrap it up, but I think we have one more question.
All right.
Just a quick one. You seemed like a really smart guy. Why did you ever run for the governor of California?
Well, I was born in Ohio. My parents came to the U.S. 50 years ago from India. I was a normal middle-class kid. I grew up mowing lawns and bagging groceries, and I feel like I have lived the American dream. My story, getting to go work in the at both the Bush and the Obama administrations, you know, this doesn't happen in any other country. This is a great country we live in. And so I learned over my life that public policy really matters. You know, I always say to people, if you want to help 1,000 people, donate to a charity. It's really important. If you want to help 1 million people or 10 million people, the only way you can do that is by improving public policy. So public policy really matters. That's why I went to Washington. That's why I ran for governor of California, to try to give people in California the same chance in life that I've had. I came in second. There's no prize for coming in second in an election. But that's why I jumped at the chance to come to the Federal Reserve, because again, it's not the same thing as being governor of a state, but you are weighing in on really important policy issues that can make a real difference in people's lives. And so, the same reason I came to the Fed.
Well, thanks for coming tonight to share this information with us.
No, thanks for having me. It's really been fun. I appreciate the questions.
And thanks to all of you for being here. It's been a good discussion, and hope you've enjoyed it. And maybe next time we'll do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.